Alrighty, welcome back to another episode of the Lookout Podcast. I hope I'm not blasting you out. I am joined by Field and Streams, Travis Hall. Thank you so much for joining me, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Luke, appreciate it, man. Happy to be here with you. It's been cool to connect with you.
Yeah, the same, man. It was great, like, just catching up here a little bit and getting to know you a little bit, because first time ever meeting you, so this is my pleasure having you on.
Yeah.
And I caught, I guess a little background, I caught your post from actually Montana Knife Company, or maybe it's just Josh Smith's account. Mm-hmm. He reposted what you posted about the land grab, and I was like, dang, man, so I gotta repost that. And then yeah. you messaged me, and I was like, yeah, man, like, this is an important topic, you know. And then I was like, and then I got to think about it like a day later. I was like, man, maybe Travis would want to come on my podcast. And it just happened that we both live in the same town.
Yeah, pretty cool, man. I mean, I have seen your truck around town because you have that sticker on the side of your truck.
Yeah, yeah.
Just being in media, I'm always interested in podcasts and stuff. So to see somebody locally doing a podcast, I was pretty interested in that. And then you commented. So I was like, hey, I know that guy, or I know that guy is around here somewhere. So
yeah, well, I just appreciate the hell out of you, man, because, like, you know, like, for folks who aren't familiar, there was a Midnight Amendment that got put on a bill to sell off, was it 1 million acres?
No, close? It was, it's hard to really pin down an exact acreage amount, but
it's like different sections of land, right?
Yeah, and the way that the amendment is written is very, it's hard to interpret, even for people that are, like, doing this kind of stuff for a living, but it's at least 500,000 acres from what I can tell. And all the people that I've talked to at, like, organizations like Trout Unlimited and Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, like, it is, yeah, a solid 500,000 acres. Most of that is in Nevada from what I can tell, but there's also a pretty substantial chunk in Utah. So at least 11,000 acres in Utah, and then probably the remainder is in Nevada.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's so unfortunate, dude, because, like, all of us outdoorsmen type folks, or anybody who just, like, enjoys nature, you know, it's like, once those are gone, they're gone.
Once they're developed, they're gone forever. And once they're sold off into private hands, I mean, it might not be developed, but they're still gone forever from the public.
And
the crazy thing about it is there are ways to dispose or swap lands, like, within the different agencies, whether it's the BLM or the Forest Service. They have mechanisms for that.
Yeah, like a land exchange kind of deal, yeah. Almost, right? Like, we'll give you this piece for this piece. And a lot of it makes sense in my world, at least. It was like fire protection. It was like, well, you guys have an office there, so you guys have that piece, and then we'll take this piece because our office is closer to this one. And then, so, like, you know, fire protection purposes, but it's still public land.
Right, exactly. And, yeah, the public gets an opportunity to kind of weigh in on those decisions when it's done through the right channels. And, yeah, we might, you know, swap land or obtain land somewhere else. Or if it's sold, then the money goes back into conservation or it goes into public lands. But with this amendment, yeah, it's just straight up sold, and the money goes into the treasury to fund whatever, like, tax cuts or something, you know. It's very short-sighted, and we just lose out big time, and it's a bad precedent to set for public land management going forward.
Absolutely, man. I couldn't agree more, dude. And, like, one of the, you know, because I started going down a rabbit hole and just looking at everything, and I didn't have time to do a deep dive on the bill or the amendment. Mm-hmm. So I was just kind of going through, like, but trusted sources, you know, like Field and Stream, like yourself, and mm-hmm. then that guy from, was it Go Hunt? Is that what it was?
Yeah, Go Hunt shared it.
Yeah. That guy was great. And so I just kind of went through and you know, you kind of sift through and figure out kind of like what the main theme is. And one person was saying, they're like, yeah, the public shouldn't pay for mismanagement of funds, because that's kind of what it was like. Well, we'll sell this to pay for this. And it's right. Like, well, no, that's not how that should work. You know, like, find another way. You know, like, getting rid of the public lands is not the answer. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly. Yeah, and putting it in a budget bill is not the way to go, and definitely not a midnight amendment that they try to sneak in.
Yeah, man. That's it. I mean, like, right, you got to do it at midnight when, you know, folks are, I mean, not that most people catch it anyways, but sometimes people would, you know, and there's, you know, all kinds of folks that are monitoring this stuff. But we were talking about right before about the one silver lining I have from it, I guess, is that now I think it's putting all of us on on awareness, I guess, or awareness is going up.
Yeah.
I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it seems that way. It seems like this has raised a lot of hackles, yeah, for sure. And I mean, I don't know if I'm in an echo chamber of people that are just, you know, hyper aware of this kind of stuff, but I feel like more and more people are aware, because this isn't the first time they've tried to dispose of public lands. Like Utah has a big lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court that actually got denied at the Supreme Court, where they wanted to transfer a massive amount of their federal lands over to the state.
Yeah.
This is just,
because that's another bad deal too, that for folks who don't know, because that's kind of the thing we're in right now. And I do not represent the Forest Service, but I do work for the Forest Service. And one of the rumors, I guess, would say, so this is a nothing connection, I guess, with anything, but I just want to put that out there so folks don't try to get me in trouble. But yeah. One of the options, I guess, the ideas was maybe transferring a lot of the federal lands, or most of it, from, like, say, the Forest Service land in Montana to the Montana DNRC, which is the state organization. And that just is not a possibility, because the state is not equipped to handle the amount of land and the budget. Because then that's the state budget versus federal budget, you know? So it's, it's not a good idea, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like a fast track to privatization, really. Because like you said, the state doesn't have
the capacity,
the funds to fight fires, for example. Yeah. Like, they're just not going to be able to do that. And
yeah, that's a really good example, actually, because, yeah, I mean, like, everything, like, my background, smoke jumping, is federal. They have a Helitech crew, but I'm pretty sure all rappelling crews are either Forest Service or BLM, just like jumpers, BLM, or Forest Service. Hotshot crews, there's two park crews, but I think everything else is federal, you know, either BLM or Forest Service. So it's like, man, like, they just, like I said, don't have the capacity to even just fight fire, let alone all the other giant projects. Like, you know, they want to raise the amount of timber we're pulling off our forests, and just that alone, I mean, like, the capacity that the Forest Service has, which is, you know, usually can handle something like that, but even the Forest Service is like, that's a big bite for the Forest Service, which is a way bigger organization, you know?
Right. Yeah, you think about the tax base that the Forest Service or the BLM is pulling from, as opposed to what Montana or Utah would be pulling from.
Yeah.
The entire country is the tax pool for the federal agencies. But if you're relegated to just the state taxes, I just don't see how they could maintain that.
Absolutely, man. And that, I actually just kind of had a little epiphany moment, almost like when, cause we were just talking about my career history and just like how I ended up here and, you know, having the structure fire background. And you think about, like, the bill or levies they're trying to pass to fund your local school, fund your, you know, first responders, such as firefighters. Like we were just talking, when I was in Great Falls, their capacity was down quite a bit to what the amount of calls they were receiving compared to the amount of fire folks or just first responders in Great Falls that were going on or that were there working. So it's like you're already having a hard time paying your EMS folks, your emergency services folks. And then now you're going to try to, like, fund a giant, you know, like, public land swap. Like, man.
Millions and millions of acres, like, insane amounts of land.
Yeah, man. And also one last thing, too, man, to touch on that is, like you said, nationally, it's funded through taxes and all that. And I think if people had a choice, which kind of wish there was, where it's like, where would you like your taxes to go? I think there'd be a lot of people, especially like everything west of the Mississippi, would be like, yeah, public lands, definitely. You know, let's keep those around.
Yeah, totally. And poll after poll, anytime, you know, Westerners or even people across the country are polled about their support for public lands, that's always, you know, keep public lands in public hands. That's the majority of what, you know, Americans say, because it's an unrivaled thing across the world. Like, no other country has 640 million acres of public ground, and some of it, you know, you can just walk out onto and hunt, you know, harvest an elk or take a dog off leash and hunt pheasants. Like, that's ultimate freedom. And that's, you know, that's what America's all about. So we can't lose that.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, there was that, I mean, like you said, there was some issues before about, and there was some, I can't remember exactly, but it was like something in Virginia where they were something happened with the deer season or something happened and they changed something or shortened it. And it was just like, there's a lot of people that sustain their family on deer meat, you know? So it's like, we were at public lands. What do those folks do? You know, and the Texas model is what always comes to my brain is like, and I fought fire in Texas a little bit and did some prescribed fire. And it's like, go down there. There's not much for public land, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing for public land really there. Yeah.
It's like, I say like someone who's got a big ranch or something, you know, pay them for a tag, right? I think. And then you can go hunt. And how many blue collar folks can afford that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a big pay to play model. And that's where we would be heading if we allow our public lands to be sold off during budget negotiations.
Yeah.
Because it just would set a crazy precedent. Because once they get one victory, they're not going to stop there. It's just, it'll be in every budget negotiation process going forward until it just dwindles away. So, I mean, that's a bleak picture, but that's kind of what could potentially happen unless this gets squashed, which hopefully it will.
Yeah, I hope so too, man. It's real. Like, you know, like you said, it'd be a domino effect for sure. It'd be like, oh, wait a minute, how'd they do that? Oh, maybe we could do something similar. And then people start digging and digging and digging. And people with deeper pockets than most of the public land users, you know? So it's like, it's a hard fight. You know, luckily we have like Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and Field and Stream and all these big organizations, but it definitely takes all of us, you know?
Oh yeah, definitely. It takes all these great conservation organizations like TRCP, Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. And I mean, everything from Ducks Unlimited to Delta Waterfowl and the Boone and Crockett Club, you know, they've been making a lot of noise about it too.
Oh, good,
and,
man.
And they have deep, deep roots that go all the way back to Theodore Roosevelt. And it's all hunting and conservation is all tied into the foundation of the public lands and just like the North American model of wildlife conservation. So it's kind of interesting how it all, like, it all ties back to the hunting.
Yeah, man. It is heritage. Yeah, totally, yeah. And people, you know, get the bad idea about hunting. And I think the great thing about folks like Joe Rogan, Steve Rinella, Cam Haynes, they're doing a lot better job of portraying what it's kind of always been. People just wanted to have this idea that it was like rednecks in the back of pickup trucks, you know, just shooting everything and that moves, you know. It's like, no, and like, that's not it at all. I would say 90% of folks are not hunting like that, you know. They're more like the Steve Rinellas and the Cam Haynes and stuff. They're going on public lands. They're trying to harvest meat for their family. Yeah, and you can, you know, it's a product you can trust because you're like, that elk's been up there grazing the bitterroots all year long. You know, like, I know what's been eaten, you know, and I feel good about feeding this to my family.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah. The quality of that compared to the meat that you're going to get at the grocery store.
Yeah, most of it. Like, you don't know where it comes from unless you're shopping more local or small town or, you know, like, know the rancher themselves, you know, like.
Right. That's an exception. Like, that's high quality stuff. But yeah, like, when you're going to the Super One and just randomly pulling something off the shelf, like, you don't even know.
No, yeah, you're taking kind of gamble on what could be.
Where it's coming from, yeah.
Yeah, how old even? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why, I mean, when it comes to public lands and ranching, I've seen a lot more people in the ranching community kind of raising their voices about this land grab thing too.
Yeah, good.
Which is cool.
That's a really good point. I meant to actually write that down because I didn't want to forget. So I'm glad you said that. The ranching community, I saw a lot of that outreach because people don't know that part. I just don't think it's as common knowledge. That part is that a lot of the ranchers have their grazing permit with like the Forest Service, the BLM or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they turn their cows loose all summer on a piece of public land, you know, and that saves them a ton, you know, and also fire prevention, you know, out there grazing the grass down, you know, that's huge for fighting fires.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's gotta be a really good economic deal for ranchers. I mean, I don't keep up with the going rates for grazing, but
same.
Sounds like it's kind of pennies on the dollar if you put it up against what they'd have to pay for private land.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because that was an issue when I was in high school a little bit, and especially afterwards was you know, being from Whitehall. Mm-hmm. A lot of those ranchers were on leased land, you know, and they'd rotate their cows through, and you know, as private land does, it sells, you know. So right. Like, then they got to find another piece of land, or you know, or the price will go up because they're like, well, we're trying to keep up with the other rates, you know? And so it's eventually the rancher's in a hard place because, man, like the economy's going up, but maybe the price of, beef isn't going up with it, you know? Because right. That's usually how it happens. It's like inflation here, but not so much here, you right. know? So yeah, that's where those grazing permits really, really help, I think, you know? Like yeah. I said, I don't keep up on it, but it just seems like it's a really good deal.
Yeah, it seems like a good thing, and it would be a shame to see it all go away because, a bunch of lands in Nevada got sold off.
Yeah, totally, man. Yeah, and it was the fellow from Go Hunt that you shared his stuff, and then I shared it from your Instagram, right?
Yep.
Yeah, like we talked about before, and I just wanted to bring it up again. Just how the intro to his video was great, and for folks who haven't seen it, you probably just go on their Instagram, probably on Go Hunt. And
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it was awesome. He's like, we're not doing enough, I'm not doing enough, you're not doing enough. And then he goes into the kind of, and well, he starts his opinion, that's right, kind of is cool. And he's like, this is my opinion. And then he like talks about it. It was kind of what we mentioned, you know, it's just like slippery slope, you know, like
right.
one domino, the rest go. And then he's like, but then here's the facts. And that was cool because like half the video was the facts and he ended it with that. And it's just like, yeah, like you kind of, like you mentioned in the beginning, like a midnight amendment, like that's a shady deal, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, if we're not doing enough or weren't doing enough in the lead up to that, it's because it was sprung out from out of nowhere. You
totally.
Know? I mean, not that there weren't a lot of warning signs, because there were, yeah. But you know, anytime Congress acts in a disingenuous way like that, I mean, that's not really the people being represented. That's more or less some paid off politicians who are trying to sneak their special interests in.
Absolutely.
Under the cover of darkness. So
absolutely.
It's been great to see the uprising though.
It is. Yeah. I think we're coming together stronger, and you know, that's what these things do, right? They bring people together, you know,
definitely.
Even though it's unfortunate, but, mm-hmm. That's exactly what, it was funny. Like after we talked about coming to the podcast, I don't know what I heard, but someone on the radio, I was just, cruising to work. And it was like, was it for the people, by the people is like the, like one of the original statements for our government. And it's like, mm-hmm. yeah, that's exactly what public lands are, you know?
Right.
Like,
oh man.
So what are we doing here? You know,
yeah.
Like that's not for the people, you know, getting rid of public lands.
Totally. Yeah. That's it. Public lands are as American as it gets. Like, I feel like they should be up there on a pedestal with the Bill of Rights, like the First and Second Amendment. It's
100%.
It didn't start with the founding per se, but I mean, it's really woven into it. The fabric of the country, I feel like it should be, held up there,
yeah.
like, with all of our most sacred rights.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Because all the special places, and you know, just from the top of my head, like I'm just going to throw a few out there, like nationally, right? So we got the Adirondacks in New York, right?
Yep,
upstate
yep.
New York, one mm-hmm. most gorgeous place on the earth. Those, you know, that's public land, so that's still there. You
right.
go down to the Everglades. Still there, you know, even you go all the way down to Tortuga, which is a national park, that's an old fort.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why it's still around is because it got turned into a monument. Otherwise, why would a private person want to upkeep a fort? You know, one, the cost of it, and two, like, what's the point?
Yeah, right,
you know,
exactly.
You yeah. put your nice house on that island instead.
Totally.
And then, you know, you work your way across, and, like, the Midwest has got a bunch of little parks, but there's that one where the buffalo graze in kind of central northern Illinois.
I don't know if I'm familiar with that one.
Yeah, it was. There's a hotshot crew there. That's kind of how I first... Madewin.
Okay.
Madewin National Grasslands, I think is what it is.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool because they introduced some buffalo there or bison there. And so it's kind of a cool spot in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
So you got like that, which is important, especially like for buffalo.
Yep.
And then, you know, you work your way across and hit the highlights, you know, like Grand Tetons, Yellowstone, Glacier Park, Yosemite. Like those places we wouldn't be able to go to.
Right.
Like a blue collar person like me, you know, who's making okay living, making a living, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
I get to go to these places because one, they're in my backyard, and two, they're affordable and they're public access.
Yeah.
If someone private owns that, I mean, and I can even speak for myself. If I own something like Yosemite, I don't think I'd want a bunch of people crawling around. If it was mine, I'd be
yeah.
like, oh, I'm keeping this. You
yeah.
know? This is me.
Right. Yeah. yeah. I mean, that'd be your right as a private property owner, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the
yeah.
fact that we have people in our history that had the foresight to set these places aside for the benefit of future generations, it's amazing. And those
yeah.
people that set it aside had the wealth, you know, they had a lot of wealth, and they had places that they didn't
Dude.
Let the public just run all over. But
yeah,
you know, they knew that we needed to preserve these places for our nation to be, to kind of live up to the ideals of the founding. So.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the preservation of all these wild places, you know, that's like one of the biggest things. And that's one thing I was going to touch about with hunting too, is it got the bad rap is that like the, you know, just going out to kill an animal to kill an animal. It's like, that's not it. And you get a tag, you can only harvest one. And it's all, most of the, you get an elk and a deer, any, you know, like 4-person family or 5-person family, that's going to set you up pretty good. You know, maybe 2 deer and an elk. Like, that's a lot of meat in your freezer.
Oh, heck yeah.
You know, then,
a lot of very valuable, good protein.
High protein. Yeah. Some of the best you can get, you know. And,
no doubt.
And so you got that. But then, you know, as hunters, like, it's an all hunters' best interest to keep that population healthy and around, and to keep the habitat, you know, good for the, those animals. And then that, in turn, you know, domino effect to, like, you know, using that word too much, but is a domino effect for like all the other creatures that use those public lands, right?
Oh yeah, totally.
Like woodpeckers and wolverines, and I'm trying to think like more of the stuff that's kind of going away, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, all those game animals that have been so closely managed because they have stakeholders that want to essentially want to go out and hunt them. I mean, that's that's why we have all the animals that we have today. I mean, not all of them, but at least, you know, the ones that we hunt. Yeah. Like, it's because the state agencies can make money from tag sales, and then that money goes back into conservation. And yeah, I mean, it all goes back to people having a desire to hunt these species so that they could keep them around and keep them from, you know, all going extinct around the turn of the century.
Absolutely, man. And monitoring, right? Like the whole time, like, I'm going to have one of my friends on who's a fish biologist, and to pick her brain a little bit more on this, because I know a little bit, you know, like, it just from growing up in the outdoors. But like, you know, elk is always the big one because it's such a cool animal. But then you think of all the fish populations that are like being monitored all the time, because they're like, what's going on with those bull trout, you know, like golden trout or whatever species, cutthroat. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how are they doing? And someone's keeping track of that population, how they're doing, you know, and keeping them around because of that. Otherwise, like, if you didn't know, all of a sudden you'd be like, man, I haven't caught a bull trout in a while. What happened to them? You know?
Right. Yeah.
And they could just be gone and no one would know.
Right. Exactly. And it's like so many of these agencies in the federal government that it's, you start looking at them all and your eyes just glaze over because it's alphabet soup, but really there's so many of them, but they all perform really important functions. And like when you're talking about fish populations, like NOAA is doing huge work for salmon and steelhead restoration in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, somebody's, one of these agencies is tracking the cutthroat and the bull and doing work on bull trout in partnership with, you know, Trout Unlimited or whoever, but all that stuff is like federal level, work that is so critical to sustaining the populations of fish and, you know, big game and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Like the whole, you know, earth ecosystem, right? You could kind of say like, we're all tied to it, you know, even though like we sometimes consider ourselves like our own thing, right? But we're all tied to it, you know, like if the forest starts to suffer and in the fish population, it's like, well, what's the reason why? And then, you know, like the fish biologists and all these folks, these agencies like NOAA and stuff are like, oh well, you know, like what was happening in the Bitter is like, oh, the temperature of the water is going way up, you know, so like a lot of the trout were going back up in the tributaries where it's cooler water, you know. And it's like, okay, well, they're figuring it out, but like still, like, this is a bad deal, you know.
Right.
And, but if no one's keeping track of that, you know, like,
yeah, no, it's comforting to know that they're dedicated, like, passionate people out there keeping track of that stuff.
Yeah.
But man, they're those agencies are being hit really hard right now. I mean, you can't ignore that. Like with the Doge stuff and all the firings that are going on, like all that stuff is in total disarray and chaos. And it's hard to see how it shakes out.
Yeah.
Going forward.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And that's the fear I think we all have, is that it's like, however it shakes out, like you said, as long as, you know, we can keep those like essential workers going and the research, cause that's what I was trying to kind of say, is that like, if you get rid of a program, say like fish biologists, like, or whatever it might be,
right?
It's like whatever data they were doing, you know, even the acid rain studies that we do on this forest, it's like whoever's doing those acid rain studies, whatever program it is, if they go away, you know, like, what would happen to those studies that have been going on for like 100 years, you know,
right.
and there's a trend that they've been following up or down, whatever it might be, you know,
right.
And all of a sudden it's gone. That data's gone.
Yeah. All that data.
And then you got to restart and then everyone's like, hey, wait a minute. Didn't we used to do this? Like, yeah. And then they're gone, you know? So yeah, that's what, like, you know, if we could do like more of a fine tooth comb of this,
right,
would be
like a scalpel instead of
the
sledgehammer, or the chainsaw, whatever analogy you want to choose.
Yeah, whatever, cutting instrument. Yeah,
yeah,
it, yeah. That's the thing, man. And so there's like impacts that keep, you know, resonating throughout, so if we can limit that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. I mean, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Dude.
I've been today working on a story about the banding, the duck and geese, all bird banding program that goes on.
Oh yeah.
And like, that's kind of on the chopping block now. And for like people in the waterfowl hunting world, it's a big deal to kill a duck or a goose that has a band. You know, people collect those and put them on their lanyards and
their duck calls
you can like submit that data to the USGS and find out information about the bird that you shot. And you know, it's a really cool aspect of hunting and conservation.
Yeah.
But there's like these wide scale cuts and firings kind of pending for USGS that could potentially wipe that program out. And that's one that goes back 100 years to like 1920. And yeah, where does all the data that's been accumulating for a century go?
Yeah.
If that thing just gets caught up in this whirlwind of firings and budget cuts.
Yeah. And if it goes, you know, especially how it kind of has been trending, like, the program gets cut. There's no one else who has access to those files.
Right.
Where do those files go? Even if there's not like a password on it, it's just like it's in some other kind of server or SharePoint file or something. You
right.
know, but like if you're not familiar with the work, you don't know where to look, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And you don't like the people that have the institutional knowledge that know how to interpret the data and are familiar with it, like you're saying, like a lot of those people are being fired.
Yeah.
So
that was one thing I brought up early too, is like the mentorship stuff. You know, like usually, you know, you have someone coming up, you know, there's like layers to agencies or, you know, any kind of business really. You know, you have like, you know, in electrical world, you have your journeyman, and then you have your apprentice, and then
right.
So they're learning underneath the journeyman, and then, you know, they turn to journeyman themselves, the apprentice turns to the journeyman, and then goes off to do great things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the journeyman may retire at that point if they're, you know, eligible or they got their time in. So it's
right.
like you get this swapping, but the knowledge gets swapped, you know? And
yeah.
If you don't have that, it's just gone, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a mess, man. I hope they can correct course and kind of undo some of the damage that's already been done in a real short period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm hoping too, man. Like, and that's what, you know, when this had first kind of started rolling, they were talking about like, well, we'll, you know, wipe everything out and then we'll figure out where the holes are, you know, and then we'll
right.
Put our fingers in the hole of the boat or whatever, you know,
right, like plug the holes.
Plug
the
holes. Yep.
Yeah.
That's the right word. And, it was like, okay, but I don't know if any of that's going on. If the holes are getting plugged or
I don't see that. Yeah. I mean, what I see is continued firings and cuts, budget cuts. I don't see any like rebuilding going on yet. It's more like the dismantling is still underway.
Yeah, totally, man. That's the fear, right? Is that like the dismantling continues and then there's no restructure, you know,
right.
of everything, rebuilding.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But that's another thing that kind of ties, I know, the message we're kind of sending is like the public lands and the awareness and like, you know, if you care about something, you know, you got to fight for it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, maybe this is the kind of thing that it takes to really create that hyper level of awareness.
Reason why when you go outside, you feel better.
Right.
You know?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and I would say times that by 100, if you get to go out and do some camping in a really remote area with no cell phone service, and it's just you and your family, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's hard to beat.
Dude.
Like that is just the pinnacle experience right there. I wish I could do it more often.
Same, man. Yeah. Yeah. When this thing finally starts kind of, you know, taking off a little bit, you know, it's definitely on the do list with the family. And that's part of the reason why I do it out of the Airstream, so I can go, like, meet somebody somewhere and, you know, interview them and then make it like a family vacation while I'm out there.
That's awesome. That's a great plan.
That's what I was thinking. And I, like, I think I was telling you when I first started before I had the Airstream, it's been my family since, it was brand new. My great grandpa bought a brand new Missoula and then my grandparents got it and my dad got it and then I got it. And at first I didn't think I was going to need it because I was telling you, all my equipment was mobile. So it was like, I'll just hike to a lookout, interview somebody, drive somewhere, interview somebody. Right. It just wasn't that practical. So my dad had this. And I was like, hey, man, could I have that?
And, yeah.
Yeah, he helped me fix it up, and here we are. But part of still my original plan was to hike with somebody across the Bob Marshall Wilderness.
Oh, nice.
And then just do like nightly little check-in podcasts. And I mean, I guess I could carry a Starlink and upload them as I go, but I was kind of just thinking about doing a collection and maybe I'll do it as I go now that I'm thinking about it, but also like maybe meeting someone on the trail and be like, hey, you know, like come join us for some coffee and maybe talk a little shop and share your story on my podcast, you know?
Oh man, that would be so cool.
Yeah. So it's kind of still in the works. So maybe one of these days, don't steal my idea, please.
No. Yeah.
No, not you. I'm talking
about it. You got it trademarked now.
Yeah.
Have you spent a lot of time in the Bob?
Oh, no, not as much. I mean, I guess 3 weeks, which is probably more than a few folks, but
yeah,
like, it was on fire. So it was like, I was kind of, tethered to an area, you know, and so it wasn't really like getting the water around, but I mean, anywhere in the Bob's amazing. So
I'm
super fortunate. Have you?
A little bit. I actually did a trip when I first moved here. Two of my cousins came out to visit and we did like a 2-night. I mean, it was super short, super quick. We went into the North Fork of the Sun, just camped for a couple nights and fished. Man, that's the best brook trout fishing I've ever experienced.
Dude, yeah, it could be some of the better in the state, that's for sure, man.
Yeah.
It's just a magical area, too, the North Fork of the Sun, just beautiful, beautiful river there, too.
Yeah, the whole hike was just like magical. It's a magical place.
It's such a magical place. And that's what it's kind of like with my experience. A lot of it was smoked in, unfortunately, but there was this knob because we parachuted into Gates Park. Me and actually Alaska smoke jumper. So it was kind of cool because I was on the round and he was on the square. So they kicked me out first and they got a little higher and then they kicked him out.
Uh-huh.
And so we're helping with structure protection at Gates Park. And then they had this high point where they were able to monitor a few different fires that were going on. They were going to converge into one, you know, big fire. And they're doing like weather obs and just like reporting of like growth and trigger points of like, mm-hmm. you know, we got ours wrapped, but there's another cabin just north of us, like horse something cabin. And so we're one day we went up there just to get a list together of like, hey, you know, if you guys could bring them either by helicopter or by, you know, jump plane cargo, you know, like sprinkler kit, pump, wrap, all the things to save this cabin. And but anyways, we're on this knob and I'd never been in the Bob before, and I flew over the Chinese Wall coming in, and the Chinese Wall is super cool because it's like right in the middle of the Bob kind of, it's hard to get to, so not everyone gets to even look at it,
right?
And so like we got to fly over it, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. And then we're sitting there and I'm looking straight up this canyon, I'm like, is that the Chinese Wall? They're like, yeah. I'm like, man, that is cool. It looks really close. It's still a ways away.
Yeah.
And I was like, I got to find a reason to go hike over there. And I never did, but there was another like little cabin up that way, between us and the Chinese Wall. But, there was two wilderness rangers that went and checked it out. And
oh, nice.
Yeah. They had a dream job, man. It was a married couple and that was their summer gig was wilderness rangers.
Oh, that's so cool.
And the Bob and scapegoat.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
So they were living in one of the cabins up there, or
they would just do like hitches, so but I think they would stay at some of the cabins as they went, but they just had a little pack string with them, and I think they're out of Augusta and they had a little home base in Augusta, and they just cruise in and do loops.
That's so cool. Yeah, we saw a bunch of those pack strings when we were hiking through there. Seems like that tradition is alive and well.
Yeah,
and
dude, especially there.
Marshall.
Yeah, there and even, you know, up the West Fork, you know, on our forest here.
Yeah, like
Yeah, Nikki's actually the packer down there. She's awesome. And
nice.
She does a great job and helps resupply lookouts and fire folks if they're out there and checks on cabins and trails and just super busy job and really great job though. And she helps supply like some of our partnership folks, our private partners like Montana, MCC, Montana. what does that stand for again? Conservation Corps. Whew. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, Montana Conservation Corps, because they'll do like a hike in our loop, and sometimes tramps from the National Smoke Trapper Association will be up there, and like Nikki or one of our other folks who can pack will help packing their gear, and, you know, for if they're, how long their hitch is going to be. Like Cat Rocks is a group that comes out of Bronx that'll come out and we'll clear trail to the lake. Like they did Carlton like a couple years ago, and I hiked in with them, and
yeah,
it was very cool, man.
That's cool. So
go ahead.
Oh, well, I was gonna ask, when fire breaks out like that in a place like the Bob, and are those cabins kind of a priority for smoke or the crews to protect and keep from burning down?
Totally, yeah. And they've been, you know, protecting them for a long, long time. You know, like a lot of those cabins are super old. Yeah. So they're really good at it. Most of them, they have the list already put together, especially for some of the main ones like Gates Park. And they still, you know, it's big, as you know, it's giant country. So as much backup as they can get. And typically smoke jumpers are just quicker and easier to get there, you know. And most of those places still have airstrips, so if need be, you can land in there too. Like you have to get permission, you know, for an incursion, but
yeah,
I think if, you know, the situation called for it, I think you'd be able to do that. And
but
yeah, it's super cool. So it's, yeah, point protection is a lot of it, you know, like for like a cabin or an old structure or something, and then you just do what you can to, you know, maybe even help guide the fire a little bit if you, you know, burning operations or, you know, whatever you can do to help make the fire go in a better direction. But, you know, you let it kind of do its thing, which is also nice, part of the natural process of things. Yeah, so
definitely.
As long as it's not burning too crazy hot and out of control.
Right.
Most fires are good fires, you know, like, not most fires, but like, there's some benefits to fire, I guess. Like,
oh, for sure.
Yeah. You get in August, and you get some of those super hot fires, not so beneficial. Not manageable, but like early season stuff and some stuff in the bog being a little higher elevation, you don't get as much of that crazy, you know, firestorm kind of stuff.
Right.
So I think you get a little more benefit out of some of that stuff and just try to preserve what's already there. And at least that's my understanding of it, I guess.
Yeah. You were here, I guess, last year when this one broke out on St. Mary's.
Yeah, the Sherritt fire.
Yeah. That was pretty interesting.
Did you see it start?
Yeah, I saw it start from my house.
Oh,
it was wild. Like, that crazy windstorm came in and all that lightning.
Yeah, dude.
And, I was just sitting on the couch with my son, and we were just kind of looking at the mountains and saw that lightning hit, and then just all of a sudden, trees were just torching.
It was like, fast.
Huh? Yeah, it happened immediately.
Yeah, dude. Like, that's that's when conditions are real bad. You know, that's when we don't want fire in the landscape, you know?
Right.
Which is, I'm glad you said that, because that was a good way to, you know, circle back to my point that I was trying to make.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, like that fire, I was leaving the gym up there by the airport canyons, and I was on the East Side Highway, I think, and I was just outside of Stevensville, and I saw the bolt hit, and I was like, huh, that was a big lightning bolt. And then, like, fire instantly. And I was like, oh, that's a bad deal. You know, 'cause the one, like you said, the wind was roaring.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, it was probably, I don't know, 50 miles, 40, 50 miles an hour or something like that.
Yeah, at least for sure, man. Yeah, it was, and they were like, well, they want looking for air resources. Because, you know, at least with, a bucket ship or, you know, Neptune Aviation, their tankers are right there in town. You know, at least you can try to knock it down a little bit until you get some boost on the ground.
Right.
And there's a lookout in St. Mary's at the time.
Yeah, there is one up there.
Yeah, and that the lookout was on there like first or second day ever as a lookout.
Wow.
Yeah, and that happens, and they had to get it evacuated.
Wow,
yeah.
So they just come in and get that person out of there, huh?
Yeah, I think they got them by helicopter, because, I mean, as you know, the whole face, and that's where the trail is, it was, you know, engulfed in flame at one point, so.
Yeah.
I believe that's how they got them off the hill.
Wow.
But I remember thinking that, too, like, right away, I mean... I don't think there's a chance that would have burned up the look. I mean, it didn't, but have you been up there?
Yeah, one time.
Yeah, so it's so rocky.
It's just all rocks, from, I mean, I don't know how many feet down from the tower, but it's pretty well secluded up there in the scree.
Yeah, totally, man.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say, like, it's impossible, because it seems like weird stuff always happens with fire, but it's, I mean, it seems like damn near impossible for that thing to burn up, because, like you said, it's in the rocks and not any fuel nearby, but
right.
Get that one weird, you know, like, fire whirl or something, and an ember gets, you know, put on the the tower and they're old and super dry.
Yeah, I guess you never know what could happen, especially with winds like that. Yeah, and exactly. You can't imagine, like, if the winds are that high, that fast down in the valley, what are they like on top of St. Mary's Peak?
Yeah. So when you were up there, did you see the footings for the old lookout?
I don't know. I remember just walking up around the lookout and checking it out.
So, like, right next to it, kind of, so if you, you know, the trail leads you up and you go, like, right past the lookout and you kind of keep cruising, there's another little observation point.
Uh-huh.
And you see, like, the Heavenly Twins and a few other peaks there.
Yeah.
So, like, between the observation point and the lookout tower, there's some concrete footings there, pretty big ones.
Yeah.
And, if you weren't really looking for it, you might not know because it kind of blended with the rock and they're aged.
Yeah.
But, when we're closing the lookout, I was looking down, you know, we put the shutters down and stuff and get it ready for winter.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was looking down at the footings and I was like, hmm. And, you know, you could tell from up above on the newer lookout that you know, the design of those four footings is what you'd see on a lookout, and especially there being a tower there.
Mm-hmm.
So someone knew, yeah, there was a tower up there, and I guess it was a 40-foot tower. And wow. Could you imagine a 40-foot tower on top of St. Mary's Peak?
That's wild.
Like, man, I don't think I'd enjoy being in that lookout because right. The wind is so nasty. And then being in a 40-foot tower?
Yeah.
So what ended up happening is, I think it was relatively early on in the life of that 40-foot tower. I think like within the second year, something got blown over, and okay. So like, well, let's go to something new.
Right. Yeah. Maybe bring it down a little closer to the ground.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little more durable structure now, but holy cow.
Yeah. Man,
I couldn't imagine because they move. You know, like even the one that guy's in, I mean, probably not as much, or that the St. Mary's folks use because it's that rock base, but
mm-hmm.
like. Most of the towers move a little bit with the wind, you know?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, they sway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I stayed in one time. It's like just south of Yellowstone. I think it was in Bridger Teton National Forest.
Whoa, very cool.
That's the only one I've ever stayed in. It's like a 5-mile hike into it.
Was it awesome?
It was incredible. Yeah, I think it's called the Huckleberry. I probably shouldn't name drop it, but
no, you totally can, man. Because yeah. Like most of them,
you got to reserve them anyways,
yes,
right?
I was gonna say recreation.gov,
yeah.
You know,
so. Yeah,
yeah, definitely, man. And it's good to spread the word. I mean, that's part of the reason why my logo is a lookout, because
yeah,
much like our public lands, lookouts are always, it feels like, on the chopping block. So
yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, instead of like naming this thing like Fire Podcast or Smoke Jumper Podcast, I was like, I want to like a symbol of the outdoors and what, you know, wildland, I guess, kind of, and just, I don't know, really like lookouts. So
yeah, I think that's an awesome symbol, man. A lot of people probably don't know that we have all these lookouts that we can just go stay in as just regular citizens. Like, how cool was that?
Yeah, it's so cool, man. I mean, that, like you said, man, that experience of being on top of a mountain in a shelter, you know, that
mm-hmm.
that's pretty well built, and get to experience life on top of the mountain for like a night or two. You know, that's, and for relatively cheap. I think some are like $40 or something.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, for a night. Like,
yeah,
pretty awesome. And then also you with volunteer programs, like the St. Mary's Lookout's on a volunteer program. So, mm-hmm. you know, folks can get a chance to experience that. And I think the volunteer program can be like a shorter stint, like you do a weekend and be a lookout for a weekend to see if you like it. Or you could do like, hey, like do like a week or two. So
yeah.
It's kind of a cool experience.
That's cool. So you can volunteer up here and you're just basically watching out for fire, and then you alert whoever if you see something.
Yeah, yeah. And my friend Reen, who's been on this podcast a bunch, she does a refresher. I think it's actually coming up in like the next couple of weeks. But everybody's signed up to be a volunteer, and then the current lookouts on our forest will go to this training, and it's a refresher for most folks. But some folks who haven't done it before, they get the rundown of what it is, you know, and there's morning check-ins with the dispatch and evening check-ins, and they check in with each other. And yeah, it's just very cool, man. And just eyes on the woods, you know, and man, some cool folks get to be our lookouts, you know, like musicians and writers and stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Didn't Ed Abbey do like a stint in a fort?
Yeah. Yeah.
Lookout tower.
I think it was up by Winthrop, Washington, I want to say.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. What did he write again? I'm blanking on that.
He wrote like the Monkey Wrench Gang, Desert Solitaire.
Oh yeah.
A lot of iconic kind of environmental journalism.
Yeah, holy cow, man. Speaking of that, like, book that I've been, I've mentioned this on the podcast a couple times is Silent Spring, I think is the name.
Oh, yeah, Rachel Carson.
Yeah, geez, that's on my to-do list. And every time I have someone like you on, I'm like, man, I gotta get that book. So I gotta read. Did you read it?
I've read a good chunk of it. I haven't finished it. I need to revisit it.
Yeah, just the excerpt of it just freaks me out because I'm like, I couldn't even imagine, you know?
Yeah, yeah, because she wrote that back when everybody was using DDT as a pesticide and it was like killing off all kinds of stuff and peregrine falcons were about to go extinct.
Dude.
That was just one part of like the environmental destruction that was happening at that time.
Yeah.
But that's one of those things, man, where it's like when things get so bad, then it spurs action. And you saw so much come out of the 1970s, so much policy and that we still have and rely on today, like the
protection, right?
Yeah, protections. Yeah, like NEPA and Federal Land Policy Management Act, all that stuff.
Totally,
like,
man.
We had Americans had an appetite for that kind of stuff back then because they were watching it all.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, you could see it in your backyard, and then a lot of it was getting more television time, and and to touch on your point too, you know, with the scalpel versus like the, you know, sledgehammer or the axe, we talked about it before we were recording, but the why, right? Like, if you're gonna like go through and get rid of a program, like, why is it there? Like, that's what I wish would happen, because there's a reason, right? Like, most of these things were established for a reason. And
right, totally.
Yeah, like, protection of, you know, peregrine falcon or whales is one thing that popped up in my brain. I think that was a 70s thing, too, right? Like,
probably,
whaling intruders. I think it was the 1970s.
Yeah.
And, like, one of the coolest species of animal on the planet is a sperm whale. And they, like, just doing some research with my kiddo, just looking up whales, you know, looking up. Kids love just anything, and I'm like, man, this is kind of cool. Let's look up some whales. And then I found out sperm whales sleep like right side up, you know, with their nose in the and like up towards the sky.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's the coolest thing. And like these pods, and they take like little cat naps. And
oh, that's wild.
Yeah, so I found out about that just because my kiddo was like, oh, you know, what's the biggest whale? And then we went down like the size chart, and somehow like this Discovery Channel thing popped up on my phone, and I was like, oh, check that out, you know?
Right.
Man, yeah, nature is just so damn cool.
Oh, it's so cool. Yeah, and it's amazing where your kids can lead you, because their curiosity is like, everything is so interesting to them, so you get, you know, you get to see the world through a new lens.
Totally, man.
Things that you, like, overlook, they're so fascinated by, so they kind of open your eyes to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. And I think those are good reminders, and kind of to touch back on the Silent Spring book, it's like, the reason why she named it that was because of the DDT, there was such a kill off of songbirds, right? That
right.
All of a sudden, like from one spring to the next, she's like, man, where's all the noise, right? The sound that she usually had, right?
Yeah, I think that's where it came from. Yeah, like the Silent Spring, the songbirds and the frogs and all that. I mean, they were gone, and it was noticeable.
Yeah.
And then, Rachel Carson was another federal employee, I think, working for, I think, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man, that's the reason why people get involved in those kind of agencies and stuff, you know, because they care so much about public lands and the outdoors, and they can see the connection. I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot of education to see, like, you know, like local lakes. Like Holter Lake is one that we go to a lot as a family, and we always have, like, since I was really young. And it's like, man, why is there, like, these bigger, you know, like, seaweed growth, you know, like beds, these bigger seaweed beds, and like in Missouri River is the same thing. It's like we used to be able to spin fish that when I was a kid, and now it's like I wouldn't put a spinner in that river anymore because you're just catching salad, you know?
Right.
So it's like, kind of forced me to be a fly fisherman, which is also kind of nice. But
yeah,
I was like, what's the reason why? You know, and a lot of it, I think it's like the agriculture runoff, you know, from
all the nitrogen kind of, the algae growth and all that stuff.
Yeah, because that affects the algae bloom too, right? Like you see in the oceans, and that affects so many fish.
Right. Yeah, you see that dead zone or whatever it is down in the Gulf.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Scary stuff, man. And if I could help spread the word on that stuff and you know, make a little more awareness, you know, I definitely want to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think awareness is key, but
How did you get involved in Field and Stream?
So I started freelancing for them like 3.5 years ago or so. And they had a full-time position open up for a news editor.
Awesome.
And I just jumped on it and got it.
Very
and
cool.
Yeah, it's been with them ever since. It's been awesome.
Yeah, Field of Stream's been around forever, huh, man?
Oh, yeah. It's iconic outdoor brand, man.
So iconic. Like, was it you posted or maybe I just went on there, but the artist that was redoing some of the old, like, they were having different artists do old covers, right?
Yeah, that's what we're doing with our covers for the new print edition. Oh. His name's Paul Puckett, that did the most recent one.
That's the one I think I saw.
Yeah. Yeah, so cool. So we took an old cover from, I think it was like 1940 or something, of a guy catching a bass in a little John boat, and just had him recreate that in a more modern style.
Yeah.
And it's awesome.
It's so awesome.
It's so cool to see, because he like kept the spirit of the artwork alive, but just modernized it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And the stuff he said really resonated with me because of the parts he said were like for his grandpa. You know, it's like that's how a lot of us get involved here, is like as kids, you know, going with our grandparents or parents, and like he had that little bass popper in there, and he say something about the John boat too or something. There was like a, you know, nod to his grandpa and a few different little things, and
yeah,
it was cool, man.
Yeah, I think he had a great story behind it, like his rendition of it. But yeah, it's really cool to see those old covers recreated. There's such a wealth of amazing artwork dating back, to, I think Field and Stream has been around since like the late 1800s.
Whoa.
Or something. And all those old covers are so cool to go back and look at.
Dude, yeah, like in the side by side with his and the old one, you know, is super cool. Because like some people will be like, well, this is my more modern interpretation, and you know, it's some art, so whatever, you know, they want to do with their art. But like, I like how his was just like a few little differences and the why behind a lot of it. Cause I love a story, man. Like in the why to a lot of things. And,
and
that was super cool. Like you said, the lily pads were about the same as the original, like a few things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. He stayed true to, the original spirit of it, but you got to be like an outdoorsman and a bass fisherman to really capture that the way that he did.
Totally, man. Yeah, that's a good point. And that's kind of like another question I had for you is, so you already had like the outdoors spirit, obviously, to get in the Field of Stream. Is that like, was that in college? I mean, like, where did you decide like that you're gonna go down this path, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up hunting and fishing in southern Indiana.
Oh, nice.
Started hunting white-tailed deer when I was probably 14 or 15 years old with my uncles and cousins, and just kind of got pretty obsessive about it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And yeah, I remember I was always just, I kind of gravitated towards writing and you know, in school that's what I was good at. I wasn't good at math or any of that other stuff, so I kind of gravitated that way and wanted to make a career out of writing. But I was also obsessed with the outdoors and hunting at that time. And I mean, honestly, Field and Stream was probably a big part. I remember carrying around Field and Stream magazines in high school and being like, well, here's how you could make a career out of being outdoors, being an outdoor writer. That's, I remember in high school kind of deciding that, wanting to go down that path. So
yeah, man, that's awesome. That's why I asked, because I think a lot of people who are in your field or mine, you're in the Forest Service, it's something that you have already like figured out at a young age. I feel like you're like, I want to be outside, or I have something to do with the outside, you know, writing about the outside, you know, or artists who like to, you know, capture the outside in a painting, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think for me, a big part of it was just like trying to figure out a way that I could, just be outside hunting and working less, and less inside working, but
no, totally,
not that it all always pans out that way, but that was the original dream.
Yeah, totally, man. Very similar, man. That's why I knew I liked you before I even met you.
Yeah.
Very, very similar, man.
Yeah.
Like, you end up in the Forest Service or chasing the same route. Tried a few different other things, but so did you go off to college for college writing or like,
Yes, I went to, the University of Southern Indiana, which is near Evansville where I grew up, and, got a journalism degree from there.
Oh, nice. Journalism. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have learned, way more on the job, actually writing and doing real journalism than I ever learned in college. But I got the diploma.
Yeah.
But all everything I've learned has been from on the job work.
Yeah, because it probably changes the way you pen things, right? Like if experiences you have and people you get mentored by, right?
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think that's, I think a lot of us who have degrees kind of the same, similar experience. You know, like I learned a lot of different skills in college. I wouldn't say my degree was like one of the big shining things, but it also like taught me how to like grind through some stuff that like I didn't enjoy, you know?
Right.
like some classes I had to grind through.
Yeah, like, discipline and yeah, getting regimented and doing the work that maybe isn't all that fun. And yeah, grinding through it for sure.
Totally, man. Yeah, builds a little character in a different way.
Yeah, definitely.
Man, yes. Yeah, did you have those monster Midwest bucks then hanging around?
Oh, yeah. Damn. Yeah, there's some. I mean, I grew up hunting what would be, I mean, what passed for public land in southern Indiana was just old reclaimed coal country that's been stripped mined. But you know, it comes back, it regenerates, and it still holds a lot of really good deer.
Yeah, you get a little topography out of that too, right? Because of the way they strip a hillside off.
Yeah, you get like some stripper pit ponds and some ridge lines and stuff like that. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. When they're done doing all that and it does regenerate, it does make for some good wildlife habitat.
Yeah.
But yeah, southern Indiana's home to monster deer.
I bet, dude. That's all you ever hear about. Like, even out here is the monster whitetails back in the Midwest.
And, yeah.
Well, even, geez, been on the Rogan podcast a few times. Like, when I first got to know about him, the bow hunter fella, man, I'm blanking out the name. But he's, you know, he's got a big place in Iowa because he just obsessed with whitetail.
Oh, I know. John Dudley.
Yeah, John Dudley.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, like, man, like a guy who's, like, that successful in his field and, you know, and you always like put yourself in their shoes. I'm like, man, if I was John Dudley, I'd be like out in Montana or something, you know, like it's right. Prime elk country. But man, there's something about whitetails that get people's veins. And then you see one in real life, you're like, I can't believe that thing's real. Like the body on him, and then you get a giant rack on its head. You're like, whoa.
Yeah.
And you start to understand it.
Yeah, they're special animals, man. There's a reason they're America's favorite game animal.
Totally.
I mean, a large part of that is because they're so widely distributed across the country, but they're also just very iconic, very fun to hunt.
Yeah, totally, man. And like, you know, like the, I think it was a camo brand or something, Timber Ghost, but it's always talking about these giant, smart, you know, whitetail bucks that you don't really see, you know, like you get glimpses of them, you never really get to see them because they're,
right.
And they're this huge animal that can move through like swamps and stuff and you know, stay hidden.
Yeah.
And then you get a glimpse at one of those things. Like me and my brother-in-law were on like a tower deer stand. We're just hanging out in the Midwest, and that's when I realized that a squirrel can also sound like a deer.
Oh yeah, totally.
You know,
like coming in on those dried out oak leaves that just blanket the forest floor.
Yeah. Oh man, it's like he knew I was there, and he was like, "I'm gonna mess with this dude." And,
right.
I mean, it sounded huge, and all of a sudden that darn little squirrel came like prancing by. I was like, "Damn it!"
Yeah, it's amazing how much noise they can make in the Midwest, or like how hard it is to walk around silently in the woods there. As opposed to like out here, you kind of get on some pine needles and just walk at even a brisk pace and not really make a ton of noise. But in the Midwest, man, it's like, that's why everybody hunts out of tree stands.
Yeah.
It's like, if you got to sit still and for hours on end, if you want to have a deer walk up into your area.
Yeah. And stay vigilant, you know, like you start spacing off and that's when like something will walk by or,
right.
You know, or catch you off guard.
Yep.
And that's, yeah, I didn't figure that out until like right about then, you know, so like I was an adult at that point, but you know, I just didn't really hunt in the Midwest, but out here, you know, the spot and stalk, like you're kind of referring to, it's like, see big animal, like, oh yeah, all right, it looks like they're going to go over this way and there's an open park over there. Maybe you can like kind of hit them off here or, you know, however you plan your hunt. And
right.
Like, or in Miles City country where it's like a little more wide open, you spot something, you're like, oh, I'm gonna get around this big knob and you
right.
know, maybe catch him on the way to the watering, you know, to water, and
yeah,
you can kind of plan it out and move,
right?
But like we're in that tower, right, and this giant buck is like circling the property we're hunting, and it's one of those deals where I'm just kind of like, well, I was after the damn squirrel, I was like a little more desensitized,
right?
So I'm just kind of hanging out. I kind of hear something. So I'm looking in the general direction, and it's fall, so you know, some of the foliage is, well, all the foliage is pretty much just gone off the trees and stuff. So it's like this bush that's got antler colored kind of branches. And I'm like kind of looking at them, and the noises come from that direction. And I'm just kind of like, I'm not like spacing out. I'm like more like enjoying being outside in like the Midwest. And I'm like, oh, that's super cool. And you know, the smells in the West are amazing because all the leaves.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, this is awesome. And all of a sudden, like, I notice something just like subtly move. I'm kind of looking a little lower, and it kind of turns slower, but like full turn, like towards us. And I was like, holy shit, that's a giant deer. Wow. And so I, you know, nudge my brother-in-law. I'm like, and he's like, you know, massive. But it, like, it looked like it was part of the damn bush because it was so huge. And then it turns and looks at us and then starts cruising away from us. And it was so big that normally my brother-in-law wouldn't try to go after him. But he's like, let's go see if we can like get to it. Cause there was like another little pond that, and like an apple orchard that he was thinking that's probably where he's staying. So it's like, well, if we can get there first, maybe we can get a shot at this guy. And not a chance. And once we started kind of cruising, I was doing everything I could to stay quiet, and there's not a chance. Like, everything's just so dry and crackly.
Yeah, you can't walk there. I mean, I guess if you had a pair of moccasins and tried to move like an inch a minute, you might be able to still hunt. But I don't know, there are guys that do it apparently. But
that's one. I'm like, man, if I could just like get my boots off. But it was cold, you know, so it was like, man. Cause I think the bow season in Illinois goes to like January or something. So I think it was like,
oh really?
I can't remember. It's long, I think.
So is that where you're hunting in the Midwest of Illinois?
Yeah, Northern Illinois with my in-laws and
nice.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. And then did some upland birds, some pheasant hunting up in Wisconsin. And
nice.
And that was cool, man, because it was 2015, so I think my wife had got a silver lab. She grew up, obviously her family's a bunch of hunters, and my dad too. And so our first dog together was this silver lab that she bought. And then I was on a fire, and like she just like did a bunch of research on this breeder. Everything sounded good, you know. This dog seemed to be great, you know, like he was smart, figuring things out, didn't have to put a lot of training into him. Didn't know how I was gonna do it on birds, because as you know, like some dogs just aren't birdie, even if it's in their bloodline. And then sometimes they're just like gun shy, like, you know, from the shot. And so we go out in this field in Northern Illinois, and I haven't done anything with this dog yet. Southern Wisconsin, sorry. I haven't done anything with this dog yet. So I'm like, and it's a hunt club, you know, so like, oh, well, we'll see how this goes, you know. And my father-in-law has his dog who's been out quite a bit and is trained, and it's running around, and my dog's kind of looking at me like, what's going on? And luckily, like, there's you guys coming out of the field. So I was like, hey, can my dog smell that just so like he knows what we're looking for, you know? So I was like, hey, buddy, this is what we're going for right now, all right?
Nice.
And so like, that's the only thing I had.
That
so
was the extent of his training.
The extent of his training. I'm a horrible trainer. Oh, horrible bird dog owner. So he's like, he kind of looks at me like, okay. And I'm like, all right, man, let's go do this. And then we get out there, and dude, right away, like his instincts kick in. And,
really?
You know, I've heard about this happening with like good, really good bloodline dogs.
Yeah.
And he just starts going back and forth in front of us. Like, I mean, like, 15 feet, you know, like right there. I'm like, oh, this is awesome, you know, just like back and forth, you know, like maybe he's getting out to like, I don't know, 20 yards maybe at the most, but like, I mean, staying close, he's not taking off. And then one of the other dogs we're hunting with is like taking off, but it's cruising so fast that it's missing some scent. So my dog kicks one up, and I'm like, and even I was surprised, I was like, oh shit. And someone shoots it, but he's in tall enough, it wasn't like cattails, but it was like something kind of tall, like grass in that the farmer had left long for birds.
Gotcha.
So it was like not super tall, but like tall enough where he couldn't see. So he just, this thing, he flushes this thing up, you know, the pheasant, and then, you know, bang. And he's like, whoa, what the hell just happened? I'm like, oh, man, this is a bad start. like, oh, this might be a bad deal. I might be ruining my dog.
Yeah.
And so he's not sure, but he still keeps doing his thing. And a few more shots, and he's looking a little more uneasy. And I'm like, oh, it's a bad deal. And I can't figure out, he can't see good enough to see, like, bird, bang, bird down.
Right.
You know, bang equals bird. So finally at the end, and one runs on us, and he's on him, and I'm like right on him. And I used to be pretty fast. Not so much anymore.
Yeah.
So I'm chasing after him, and in my head I'm thinking, like, I gotta get this bird up, and I gotta shoot this bird so that my dog can see it and then recognize, like, oh, bang is good.
Right, you know? Right. Associate that with a dead bird that you can go get.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So, like, finally this thing, like, I don't know why, but it finally, like, decided it's going to take off, you know, and I think it might have been in, like, some more, like, tall grass. But my dog wasn't in the grass at this point. Like, he's chasing, but it pops out, and it goes right by his face, and he, like, kind of lunges at it, but he still doesn't really know what to do with it, so he doesn't really put too much effort in. But it goes past him and then, you know, presents itself right in front of me. So it's like priority, you know, bang, bird down. He gets to be like a little, like he kind of flinches and then he sees, oh, bird. And then goes right, gets the bird, brings it back to me. And I like, you know, super pumped. So I'm like,
nice.
Let him know, like, good boy, that's what we're doing. Yeah, right. I did such a good job praising him, you know, giving him a bunch of like positive reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, man, he was just awesome.
Like, wow, he's been good ever since.
Yeah.
Man, that's got to be like the dream scenario for training a bird dog.
Yeah, because we got him during fire season, so I was gone most of the year. And I think my wife may have been like just, I mean, she taught him most of the basic skills, you know, retrieval and sit and stay and all those things. But I think I was borrowing a dummy from my dad and some scent, but I never like really got a chance to mess with him with it.
Yeah.
And then it was awesome because then here at the Lee Metcalf, or, you know, for folks listening, we're at the Lee Metcalf.
Yeah.
And,
beautiful place,
man. Yeah, I was like, dude, I can't think of a better backdrop to talk to you, good sir.
Yeah, I was stoked when you said you wanted to meet out here.
Yeah, I was like, oh, man, that's a great spot, you know, and I mean, the weather's perfect.
Oh, it is, man. The sky is incredible.
It is, man. And so flash forward to my dog's next experience is here, and we never did any, like, duck waterfowl hunting, you know, before, just because... There's not a lot of, in Montana, it's just not a lot of water to access, and being from Whitehall, there was a few options, but I just didn't really get into it. My dad had done a lot as a kid, and he spent a lot of time in the Midwest as a kid, so I had experience and, you know, did a little bit with my dad, but nothing crazy. So anyways, my brother's out here, and he gets blind, and me and my little bro are running late, so we're coming, and I'm the only one with the dog, and so same hunting dog is with us, and just a lone goose comes cruising over, and so me and my little bro like hit the deck, and I got my dog, and my little bro starts calling for my older brother, and man, it just worked out perfect. Kind of flew right over my older brother's head.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, shoots the goose, gets it down, but as you know, goose are really resilient, not totally dead at this point,
right?
And it's in the water, and so I let my dog go, and he saw it all. Luckily, he was paying attention. He goes out, and then my brother kind of helps give him a little more direction. So, points. Dog hits the water hard, you know, like some awful cool, like, training video. I'm like, dang, man, I'm already a proud, like, dog dad already.
Yeah.
And then cruises out, gets the bird, and I think the bird was pretty much done at that point, but still, like, it was moving enough to, like, and, you know, goose is giant.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a really big bird. Yeah. Like, this is, like, the size of my dog.
Yeah, wow.
So, and I mean, it's on its way out, so it's moving a little bit, but like enough to where like I've seen a dog not want to engage because they're that big animal's moving. But my dog just swims up, grabs it, brings it back to my brother, and my brother's holding it, and he's not the tallest guy, but I mean, from beak to tip of the web foot, I mean, it's good, close to his height, you know, like at 5'7" or whatever he is, you
big
know,
big goose.
Yeah, it was a monster. I was like, man, awesome. And yeah, just things clicked, and
that's awesome.
Yeah, just super lucky, you know, because I know people, you know, who've paid for more expensive dogs ever and a better bloodline that just, you know, end up not having one that was birdie or have one that's super birdie and more than my dog. So I just got super lucky. You got a bird dog?
I do not, no. I have a 15-year-old chow mix.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Damn.
Very ornery.
That is awesome. Yeah, I bet, man.
Yeah, we picked him up at a rescue center in Charleston, South Carolina, like forever ago.
And oh, really?
He's been with us ever since.
Oh, man, very cool, though.
Yeah.
Rescue dogs are the best. We got a rescue Pyrenees.
Oh, nice.
Seems like they know, right? They're like, oh, thank you.
And yeah, I think at one point he did know and was appreciative, but he's since forgotten.
Yeah, that's awesome, man.
Yeah, but yeah, I would like to get a bird dog, though, one of these days.
What breed would you go for?
I don't know, man.
There's a lot out there. Yeah,
there's a lot. I was on a pheasant hunt in October, kind of out near east of Billings, and the guide had a German short hair, which is a really cool dog.
Yeah.
I enjoyed watching him. I don't know. I might consider one of those, but
yeah, pointer's nice, right? Because then like they don't flush typically, unless the, mm-hmm. the bird's real jitterish, like jittery, I guess, or I don't know. For some reason, the bird jumps up. Yeah. Most of the time, you know, it'll be out a little ways away, just pointing at it. It's so cool to see, like,
yeah,
like a short hair just cruising, and all of a sudden,
oh, yeah, it's awesome.
Statue. Yeah,
it's so awesome to watch them go to work.
Yeah,
because it's like how many thousands of years of genetics bred into them to do those jobs.
Totally,
and they're
man.
Just out there living their dream, man.
Yeah, and they just love it so much, man. And it's like such a cool thing to have a little bit of a different. Like for you and your child, right? Like, you guys have this awesome relationship. There's this symbiotic relationship with humans and especially dogs. Mm-hmm. And then you put another layer on it when it's helping you gather meat for your family.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, totally.
It's like, oh, man, it's so cool.
Yeah, yeah, because that's why dogs are originally, you know, with people, right, to help them hunt.
Yep.
So keeping that tradition alive, I think, is super cool.
Totally, man. Yeah, and like you said, when it's bred in them, and I mean, there's other dogs, like my dad has this bulldog that had a hell of a nose on him. You wouldn't think it. It's like a lap-haul blue-lipped bulldog, kind of a rare one, but still kind of a little bit of a stuffed nose because he was kind of snorting.
Yeah.
But man, my dad would get a pheasant roaming through his property every once in a while, and that bulldog would get on it, and he'd catch it, and he's
like, really? Nuts. He gets it?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's like zero training, you know, zero bloodline being a bulldog. And that thing had a nose on him. My dad was like, this is nuts.
Yeah. I mean, you go back long enough that those bulldogs were bred for some kind of purpose.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what it was, but.
Yeah, me either, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So cool, though, to see that. Like, and that, like you said, that breeding, the selective breeding that, mm-hmm. that brings out those traits, like the pointer or, you know, like my dog, you know, being a Labrador Retriever, you know, like mm-hmm. a little bit different, but still similar tool, you know, or similar, you know, use, I guess, is, you know, for those dogs.
Yeah.
And then you get like your sled dogs that are, you know, these, you know, long distance just beasts, you know, that can pull those sleds, like the, you know, in those races and stuff. But it's so cool. And the relationship that the musher has with their dog.
I saw
a specialist winter when I was holed up during one of our cold, you know, nights. And it was just super cool to see like people, preparing for that Iditarod and the traditions that go along with that and with the dogs and stuff too. So
yeah,
it all kind of connects.
Yeah, it's cool stuff, man.
Yeah. My dad was going to ask me if you knew of a writer. He's like, I can't remember the name of him, but he wrote for Ducks Unlimited back in like 1980, I want to say 79, 80.
Okay.
So odds of that person still working there, probably pretty thin.
Probably. I don't know. There's some guys that have been around for a long time, though.
Well, that's what I was thinking, especially like it's a passion. It's a work of passion, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Like how you got into it, right?
Yeah, I think that's how most people gravitate towards it, is just a passion for the outdoors and then obviously writing skills. But for me, like, I had the passion for the outdoors and a little bit of a knack for writing. But when I started writing for Field and Stream, I wasn't like... I had a lot to learn still.
I've
had the privilege of working with a lot of really good editors that have helped me and brought me up to speed with the style. But
so, like, I guess going through the process, you'd write something on a subject, whether it's like upland birds or whatever it might be, send the editor, he sends notes, and then you make adjustments?
Yeah, I mean, these days it kind of depends on the topic, like... you know, a bigger, more heavily reported story, there'll be more collaboration with editors for sure. And I'm kind of like sending back and forth and we're kind of, collaborating that way. And then there'll be stories that are just kind of quick news and I just write those and put them up.
You probably get enough miles on you, right? Where you can like, oh yeah, that's no big deal.
Yeah. I mean, that took a while to get to that point, but I mean, the best writing is always a product of collaborating with a good editor. I feel like,
yeah, it's always important to get a second set of eyes on anything, mm-hmm. especially writing. I feel like, cause for me, I'm not a great writer by any means, but like if I get to writing something, I'll leave out like chunks of things sometimes because I'll like my brain will be going too fast and my pen, my hand or, you know, type, you know, whatever, the typing isn't keeping up, you know.
Yeah, it's easy to do, and sometimes I have the opposite problem where I add in way more than I need.
I was gonna ask you about the descriptive part of it, like, yeah, because you probably got to be pretty descriptive though to paint the picture for the reader, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you're writing a narrative piece, you're gonna have to be much more descriptive and kind of better at describing this scene. A lot of stuff I write is like straight news, so you don't have to go into that as much. But I mean, I think the best writing is descriptive narrative type storytelling.
Totally, man. Oh, yeah, and I was going to touch on your point about, like, folks who can write in their later years. Norm MacLean, who wrote Young Men in Fire, got the copy.
Oh, you got
right
it up there.
There.
Nice, man.
Yeah. I mean, that was published after his death, and that was, he wrote that in his later years, and, I mean, great writing, you know?
Amazing writing. Yeah, I just reread A River Runs Through It. Just finished it the other day.
Yeah, so good, huh?
Heck of a story. Yeah. The interesting thing about that, it's, I guess you would call it a novella, but it's like 105 pages long or something, and there's not a single break. It's just one, I mean, there are paragraphs, but it's just one big block of text, basically.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, so like, you read a book today, it's always broken down in like more digestible chapters, like a modern book.
Yeah.
But the way he was writing, and it stands up, it's amazing, and it's one of the best short stories ever told.
Totally.
But it is interesting. The way that he didn't include like chapter breaks or anything, it's just one big solid block.
I didn't even remember that. It's been so long, you know, because that was like a childhood read, kind of. I think it was like when I got my hands on it, and I probably didn't even do a good job of getting through the book, you know.
Yeah,
but, man, that was interesting, dude.
It is interesting. Yeah, the first time I read it, I think I was in high school, and I remember coming out to Montana for the first time shortly after that.
What I like about that, and you kind of touched on it, is that there's a certain thing, like you said, that's more digestible about writing, but like if it's a good, well-written story, it doesn't matter how it comes out, right? Like,
right.
It's still good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still amazing. It still stands up.
Yeah. The power of writing, man.
Yeah. Yeah. The way he wrote, it was very, very poetic.
Hard
to beat.
Really hard to beat. Yeah, I mean, even like this, I think it was like a lot of notes that his son and another editor or somebody maybe helped kind of piece it together after his death.
Yep.
And it's like, man, I mean, like you said, like the descriptions and especially probably after I read it before I was Smoke Jumper, and then I read it recently because the 75th anniversary of Man Gulch was last summer.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, so I'm like, I better reread this. And so I was like, I don't know, maybe, and being older, you know, that's a great thing about writing in books is like, you can read the same book twice, but give it a few years and you'll get, I mean, you know, probably not even a few years, but definitely like for me, if I give it a few years, it's almost a different book because I'm getting my life experiences and I'm getting more out of it. And maybe I'm more patient with my reading, you know?
Totally.
It's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. You glean new insights from it every time, you know, based on.
And the story hasn't changed.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's cool, man. Powerful stuff, dude. Writing's important and reading's important.
Yeah, I think so too.
Is there a book in your future? What do you think?
Man, I would like to. I don't have any immediate plans, but that's always something that I've aspired to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, working with Field and Stream, I've gotten to know a lot of people that have actually done stuff like that. So made more connections with people that could potentially help make that happen. So
totally, man.
It's definitely a dream for sure.
Yeah, that'd be cool, man. Especially with your skills, you know.
Yeah.
Like, not everyone has it. I'm one of those people who doesn't, you know. So like, be super cool to use your talent towards it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I do what I can. I mean, I'm. Like I said, I've learned a lot since I've gotten a lot better at writing just because of working with Field and Stream and working with people that have so much experience, and their experience comes from working with, you know, people that mentored them. It's kind of cool how that all just trickles down and continues on. But
absolutely, man. And I think that's what's super cool about like Field and Stream, the Forest Service, like I mentioned, Rocky Mountain Canelo Foundation, Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, all these organizations, very inclusive, I feel like. It's like, if you're showing interest, they're like, yeah, would you like to know more? Or help? Would you know, I can help you more, or I can point you in this direction, this person can help more.
Right.
Yeah, it's so cool, man.
Yeah, definitely that mentorship, and yeah, bringing new people in.
Yeah, and everybody's welcome, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that kind of goes back to our topic of the public lands. It's like, it's for everybody, you know? It doesn't matter what your political compass is. Swings, you know, it's not a political thing. It shouldn't be.
I mean, it needs to be completely apolitical.
That's what I was looking for.
I feel like it should be separate. Unfortunately, I think it kind of gets dragged into that quagmire right now, because just because everything does, we everything. Live in such a divisive political climate. But
yeah.
I think the public lands need to be completely separate from politics. And a big part of that is just education. Like yeah. people need to understand what we have and what we stand to lose. I think there's a lot of people that just don't totally get it. Like, we have 640 million acres of public land managed independently by all these different agencies. It gets a little confusing.
Yeah. What's what?
Yeah, but all it takes is going one time on, you know, Forest Service and camping in a dispersed spot that where you can just drive up wherever you want, you yeah. know, and just pitch a tent, or going backpacking 5 miles in and pitch a tent wherever you want.
Yeah, man.
When you get a little taste of it, that really changes things.
Get to have a cup of coffee in somewhere wild.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely.
Those are mornings that you can't recreate anywhere. I don't care what virtual reality or what kind of like park you have in a town. It's not the same right. as being out in the wild.
No,
you know?
No, it's not the same, man. Yeah. And like I said, no other country really has it the same way that we have it here. So
absolutely, man.
Hopefully we can hold on to it.
Yeah, I hope so too. I got one more thing to ask you about writing. Is that, do you think it's true, I guess? And I kind of think maybe, what's the old saying? Like, everyone's got one book in them. Is that the old saying or something like that?
Oh, I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, I think someone told me that one time. Like, everyone's got one good book in them.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true for me, but.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, it's just a matter of, like, dedicating the time and doing the work.
Yeah.
And getting into some kind of a routine, I guess, sitting down and doing a little bit every day until it accumulates into what you're working toward.
Into something, yeah.
Yeah, no, I like that saying, though.
Yeah, and I think it is too true. Like, even if it's not about you, it could be about something that you're passionate about, you know? Like, like Norm MacLean, he you know, had some fire experience. He was a lookout for a minute, but
right.
He wasn't a smoke jumper, you know? And,
yeah.
But he connected with that tragedy and wrote a book on it, you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, so... Yeah, anybody can write about anything, I guess, which is the cool thing about it.
Yeah, definitely. Didn't Norman MacLean work for the Forest Service, like, out of Hamilton?
Maybe Hamilton, but I think Powell Ranger Station is where he was at for a little bit.
Okay.
I think that's where he did some of his lookout time. But maybe Hamilton, too.
I remember reading one of his stories that was talking about, like, hiking up into Blodgett Canyon.
Yeah, that's the isn't the ranger the cook in the hole in the sky?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, because it came out of Blodgett. What it was, they were at, like, I want to say Elk Summit Ranger Station, which is just past Powell. So if you go up Highway 200, the turn's like right around where Powell Ranger Station is, and it's just a little bit south.
Okay.
And it's on a road, you can drive there. And then, but there was a trail, and a pretty well tracked trail, because the rumor is that a sawmill, was put at Elk Summit that came from Hamilton and was packed in by, you know, pack strings through that route up Blodgett into Elk Summit. And then cool thing about the mill is, and they knew it, so it was designed this way, was just during high water, during runoff and spring runoff, that's when they'd mill their lumber. So they'd mill like crazy. So that time of year, that's like all hands on deck, let's mill. And then they'd mill this lumber, and then they'd make lookouts or, you know, cabins or whatever structure they needed out of the milled lumber right there on site. So
wow.
Pretty cool, huh?
That is cool. Were they doing it during the runoff because they were, like, floating the logs down? Or
no, just because, like, it was the mill was powered by the...
Oh, by the water.
By the water, yeah. Okay. So it was, like, that big paddle.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I guess I can't think of a better word for it. But, yeah, so, like, the big paddle, you know, it's the only time it had enough force to power the mill to cut the lumber. So
wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I guess there's little remnants of it there. But, yeah, I think in that story that... they were stationed there at Elk Summit, I want to say. And then, you know, it was a poker game that they were, you know, want the cook to come play for them.
Yeah.
And so they come over to Hamilton, I think through that trail through Blodgett.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But he might have worked. I'm kind of fuzzy on his background.
Well, I think I was just thinking of that connection between Hamilton and that story and, like, Blodgett Canyon.
Yeah. Glad you brought that up, because I always forget about that one, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I never made those connections until I moved here, obviously. Like, I didn't know all those place names and stuff, and I started looking back at those old Norman MacLean stories. I was like, he was right around here doing all that stuff as a kid.
Totally, man. It brings it a little closer to, like, his work and then, like, your work as a writer, I imagine, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And that connection.
Yeah, he's always been a big inspiration.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to keep you too long, man. I don't even know how long we've been here. Kind of lost track of time. Gee, man. How long do you want to take a stab at how long we've been here?
Hour and 20.
Yeah, man. You about nailed it, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, about an hour and 24 is okay. What I was saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had one more story actually I was going to tell you. And then before I quit bugging you for the evening.
Oh, no, you're good.
Do you have to be anywhere?
Oh, no. No, I'm good. I'm wide open, man.
Yeah, kind of same. I usually try to leave a pretty good block of time because, especially first meeting you, I knew you'd have a lot to talk about, but you never know. And you might have something going on. So you go in from a quick 20, 30 minute podcast to a couple hours.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, stories, right? And especially writing. I was talking to my dad and told him, I was like, yeah, I met this Travis fella and we're going to, do a podcast about public lands. And he works for Field and Stream, writer. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, cool. And that's when he asked me if he knew, I wish I could remember the fella's name for Ducks Unlimited. But I was like, oh, wait a minute. I was like, I haven't really shared the story with anybody. And it's a pretty interesting story. And it's something you don't think of because you grow up with stories from your parents or your family, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my dad was duck hunting in Northern Illinois.
Okay.
And it was him and his youngest brother, and they're in a John boat, I'm pretty sure, and they're in a blind, and there was a group of younger, maybe right around his, but maybe my uncle's age, younger, four dudes out, younger dudes,
mm-hmm.
also hunting and duck hunting, and they went about the same time. I think my dad beat him out there and saw him come across the water from the dock, where they put in, and go to their blind and set up and stuff, and they're in a little John boat, and dad said when they were coming out, when they put in and with all their gear and everything, that thing was barely above the water line, right? Just full. And he said it was in November, and this was in 1979, 1980. A big storm kicked up. So, especially the Midwest, those lakes will get chopped up big seas actually.
White
for
caps.
Yeah, for a small, mm-hmm. small lake. So these four dudes get in their John boat. And they're going to send it back to the dock and try to just beeline it back. And I think they were doing an all right job, but they were just overloaded.
Right.
I think they had a 10-foot John boat. And so my dad sees they're taking on water. Dan's the thing went from a John boat to a submarine real quick.
Yeah. In the middle of this big storm.
So my dad's got a John boat, but it's just him and my uncle. And I'm pretty sure he had my uncle stay in the blind. And my dad's John boat was a little bigger. I think he still got the same one, maybe a 15 footer or whatever. The next length up is bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad beelines it for these guys just in time for it to take its last swell and go, under. One guy clings on. My dad scoops up. So there's four of them. So my dad scoops up two of them that are on the surface and then sees just an arm going under the water and just far from these two dudes.
Uh-huh.
So my dad and the muddy water in the Midwest. Oh, it's not clear like Montana lakes.
Right.
And it's all chopped up so you can't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to think how it worked out. So I think the order of the process of how things went down was he's able to scoop these two dudes. They were I'm just gonna make up a name, Mike's still in the water. And my dad's Mike. And my dad looks over and I think that's when he sees just fingertips going under the water.
Yeah.
And so my dad cruises over there and it's deep enough water where it's this dude hits the bottom, nothing anyone can do. And he's in all his duck hunting gear, probably a lot of goose down stuff, so it's heavy. So my dad just bails over the side, not totally, but gets himself as deep in the water as he can, and he's just frantically feeling and just catches the dude's coat sleeve.
Wow.
Yeah, the dude's sinking to the bottom.
Wow.
Catches the dude's coat sleeve, gets him in the boat, and he's in bad shape, but breathing.
Right.
So my dad gets him in the boat, and then there's the fourth dude. He clung onto their John boat, uh-huh. luckily it's still floating, and he's floating off. So my dad waves down a dude in a walleye boat, which is going by. And for folks who don't know, a walleye boat's got higher sides,
right.
So mm-hmm. built for more of that bad weather.
Yep.
But was able to flag him down, get him to go get that guy, and then. But these dudes are froze to the bone. November
yeah.
in the Midwest,
oh my gosh,
freezing
yeah.
snowstorm coming in. So
hypothermia setting in.
Hypothermia. So. I think it was his mom's place. My grandma's was not too far away. So raced him up to the house and she just kicked him all in the shower, the hot shower, and they all hauled in there. And then I think, I don't know if they ended up needing an ambulance or something, but, somehow that story got out though. And, a guy from Ducks Unlimited, came and wrote a story and they awarded my dad with an award for saving four dudes. So,
really?
Yeah. Pretty cool.
So they did Ducks Unlimited put it in their magazine or?
Yeah. My dad still got the article and at one of the big banquets they honored my dad. So
oh, that's so cool, man.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And
wow.
The illustration they did for the article is pretty cool because I think they did like an illustration and then like did like text along the illustration. It was just like my dad's arm and the dude's hand.
Oh wow, cool. I wonder if you can. Is that online at all? Has it ever been digitized?
I don't know. I've never looked. I'll have to see. I've only seen like his copy. You know,
it's probably just only in print if it's from the 1980s.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking too. I mean, I know they're trying to digitize more of that stuff, but
yeah, they can only do so much. Well, that's amazing.
But yeah, cool story, huh, man? Yeah. Like, and yeah, like you forget about those kind of things, you know? Like, oh wow, man, I never had had that kind of experience in myself, you know? And I worked in the first responder world for almost 20 years, you know? And like, I've never had anything like that happen. So yeah, it's kind of a cool story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. Is that kind of something that inspired you to go into that field?
Yeah, probably, because my grandma, you know, the same person he took those four dudes to her house, she was on ski patrol, and she had some kind of award and article for her saving someone's life on the ski hill, so it was kind of like, I guess in the family bloodline, I guess, and me loving the outdoors, I think, is why I'm going that route.
Yeah.
And I always liked the idea of like search and rescue stuff too, you know, like going out and helping people who are in need, you know, and never really got involved with it because it's not really like, at least out here, there's not like a group or agency or something that does strictly like search and rescue. Usually it's volunteer groups and, you know, like sometimes they'll call in like Forest Service, like historically the Smoke Jumpers have done a few like rescue jumps. One in particular was when Quake Lake happened.
Oh yeah.
That big quake on Quake Lake by Yellowstone.
Yep, near is that close to Ennis?
Yeah, really close to Ennis. Yeah. And you know, that big slide happened, you know, and it blocked the road on either side, I think is how it ended up going. And so Smoke Jumpers are right there in West Yellowstone, so they load up a bunch of jumpers and they jumped the slide, you know, the quake, and then like help rescue some folks and so maybe that's kind of why I went down that route. I don't know, you know, probably a mix of many things, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure that had some kind of effect on you subconsciously or otherwise.
Yeah, totally. And growing up with the duck hunting family, you know, and just, you know, hunting family and outdoorsy family, you know, like I got involved in the outdoors at a very young age and got to see some really special places in the Midwest as a really young kid, and then out here in Montana as well. So my dad's little stomping grounds, and then it's my great grandpa's and my dad's little places out here in Montana. So
nice. Yeah. So your dad is born and raised in Montana?
No, born and mostly raised in Illinois. Okay. And then out here, and I was born in Illinois, and then moved out here in when I was 13. Yeah, I think that's right. 13. Okay. Yeah.
Nice.
But what ended up happening is my great grandpa moved to Great Falls back like during the Depression. And I think he just was following the railroad and following work and ended up in Great Falls. And then his daughter was in Great Falls, and there's Malmstrom's, the Air Force base there.
Mm-hmm.
And so she met my grandpa, who was in the Air Force, and then they went to actually Bermuda from Montana.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then so my dad's oldest brother, was born in Bermuda, and then I think he got stationed in Illinois. I'm not exactly sure how they ended up back in Illinois, but he had family back there. That's where his folks were, was in northern Illinois. And so they spent, you know, most of their middle age there, I guess, you know, like raising their kids, and then came back out to Montana retirement in the early 90s and lived the rest of their days out here in Montana. And,
nice.
And they had a chunk of ground just down from Craig. Are you familiar with the Missouri, Craig area?
Yep.
Yeah.
Floated the Missouri River out of Craig before.
Yeah, beautiful spot, huh?
Yeah, some really good fish in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man, so good. The Dearborn, right where the Dearborn flows in, they're just a little bit downstream of that is where my grandma's place is. And then my great-grandpa's is just a stone's throw from that, so
that's a lot
of my stomping grounds growing up.
That's a beautiful part of the state. I need to get back over there.
Yeah, totally, soon. Man. That's one of the special things about Montana is the diversity, right, of areas.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it's way different than here, you know? I mean,
yeah,
there's similarities, but it's still different, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's Montana is just amazing that way. You could go from here to the Big Hole Valley and you're in like a totally different place with like a whole different environment. Or you go from here to like over into Idaho, like the Jerry Johnson Hot Springs area. And that's like a temperate rainforest or something.
It is, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, you can just be in, you know.
Just a short drive away.
Yeah. Yeah, all kinds of opportunities to change up your scenery around here.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, Travis, dude, I appreciate your time, man. Do you want to blast out your social media for people to find you?
Yeah, I'm just on Instagram, Travis Hall Media. And that's kind of my main thing as far as social media goes.
Is on Instagram there?
Yeah, just not really on Instagram, so.
Yeah, and for folks listening, definitely check it out, because that's where I've been getting all my information is from your feed there on Instagram. So I really appreciate you posting and keeping my awareness up, because like we've mentioned earlier, it's on all of us to preserve these public lands, you know?
Yeah, man, absolutely. And I'm glad that people are getting fired up about it. We got a lot of work to do. But yeah, and then Field and Stream on Instagram too. My work is on there too. And there's all kinds of great stuff on the Instagram page and the fieldandstream.com website. And we have a print magazine that comes out twice a year, which is really awesome.
It's awesome. Switching magazines are kind of on my way out. So
yeah. Yeah. And those are, you'll be able to pick those up in Tractor Supplies.
Really?
This spring issue. Yeah. It might already be there. Like, I need to go check the one in Lolo.
I was just going
to
say, man, next time I'm going through Lolo, I'm going to stop in.
Yeah, yeah, they should have it.
Yeah, man. And, you know, it's a responsibility we all have as U.S. citizens is to preserve public lands for the next generation. And that next generation's counting on us because they can't do anything about it. You know, like our kids, their kids, you know, like if they go away, they don't get to enjoy the things we got to enjoy. So
exactly, man. Yeah, it's like. Theodore Roosevelt said, those in the womb of time, like, we have a responsibility to preserve this stuff for them, because, like you said, they can't do it for themselves, and the generations that came before us did it for us, so we got to pick up the torch.
Absolutely, man. Wow, that's a great way to end her. Well, thanks, Travis. I appreciate your time, man.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Luke. I appreciate you having me, man.
Yeah, dude. Well, yeah, we'll do another one. Appreciate you.
Yeah, definitely. Let's do it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for listening. Appreciate you, folks.
Thanks a lot.